As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, Liverpool Man United. More attempts without hitting the target than apple-eating teenage Michael Owen. We discuss that game and core problems for the other Manchester side, City. Plus, the other weekend news, Chelsea's Youngkin Cole, Fulham's Jimenez to Society, and much more in this Totally Football Show. Sunday the 17th of December. Hello. I'm here in the Totally Football studio with Adrian Clark. Hello, Adrian.
Hello.
All right. We're joined by, as remote as Burnley survival hopes, Daniel Storey and Matt Davis-Adams.
Hi, James.
Hello, Matt Davis-Adams.
Hi.
Yeah, there he is. Matt's in a bit of a grump, listeners.
This is outrageous. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here and talk about a wonderful weekend of football if we stay away from Friday night, maybe.
All right, then. Friday night, huh? Well, it's a weekend with so many elements to it. One above all, our thoughts with Luton skipper Tom Lockyer, who began the weekend eagerly awaiting his side's match with Bournemouth and continuing the Hatter's spirited battle with the drop that he's currently recovering in hospital after collapsing 65 minutes into the game away at the Vitality Stadium with a cardiac arrest. Thankfully, Sunday he's been described as stable. Alex Brody of The Athletic joins us now for a quick update. First of all, what's the latest on Tom and how he is?
So the latest from Luton is that he's still in hospital having tests. The club put out a statement Sunday afternoon saying, could he kind of just be left alone and wait to see what the test results are before any kind of decision going forward is. And obviously the thoughts of the club and everyone with Tom and his family at this time.
What does he represent to the club, Tom Lockyer?
As with a few players in the squad, a good example of how the club's progressed, done well in the Championship and then stepped up to the Premier League level, as I think they have in quite a few games this season, the club as a whole. But Lockyer kind of represents that as the captain and a goal-scoring defender. He's kind of come through the leagues, as Luton have, and he hasn't looked out of place at all at the highest level.
Scored in Luton's first ever Premier League win. Was career very much a secondary question now as he recovers in hospital? But Luton, who went on to win that playoff final against Coventry that he collapsed in back in the summer, no question of them continuing this game here. How do you feel the club is going to respond to this?
As I said, they kind of want to wait and see what the test results are. And I guess the interesting thing will be the decisions that are made going forward that Tom obviously has to make with his family and with medical kind of advice, obviously. And the club will obviously just have to give him time to make that decision. I guess he returned after the collapse in the playoff final. He then had tests and it was felt he was fine to return and he wanted to return. This, I think, having happened again, 7 months later, must be very difficult for him to make that kind of decision what he does with his career going forward, really.
Alex Brody there. Well, I'm sure we're all really grateful that Tom received such immediate care and is now doing better. But second time this year, Daniel, you were there in the championship playoff game where he collapsed shortly after the kickoff.
Yeah, I was. And I think, you know, when the dust settles on this incident, and mercifully it sounds like Tom is going to be okay in his health. We don't know about his professional career yet, but that clearly comes second. There probably will be an examination of he was cleared to play after that initial collapse. I think it's probably fair to say that it would be a strange coincidence if these two incidents weren't linked, and therefore that there may have to be an re-examination of those, you know, how we assess players, because you know, football is not everything. A player's health is of paramount importance above everything else, and we have to protect players in these incidents. And yeah, I mean, obviously the main thing is that it sounds like Tom is going to be okay in the long run. We got a kind of report before the game had even been due to finish that he was kind of at least awake and responsive and on his way to hospital. But yeah, once is too much for a player. So twice, I mean, goodness only knows the fear he was going through at that moment.
Yeah, and for everybody who was there on the pitch and at the ground, Adrian, you something similar happened in a game that you were playing in.
Yeah, I've experienced this, and it was undoubtedly the most harrowing experience of my career. It was come towards the end when I was playing non-league football in 2005, and it was a Kent Cup senior semi-final against Folkestone. I was playing for Margate at the time, and yeah, the centre forward Paul Sykes was just running towards the halfway line and just hit the deck, and I still can't get the image of his face, you know, out of my mind, to be honest. I can go right back there, because it was something I'd never want to see or experience again. It was awful, and we obviously all left the field and left the medics to deal with it. And unfortunately, in this case, Paul didn't make it, and it was later discovered that he had a heart defect that they were unaware of previously. And yeah, we played the cup final, and it was dedicated in his memory, and his wife and young son were there and presented us the trophy. So it was an unforgettable experience, but not in the right way.
No, of course not. Poor chap. It seemed totally logical this game didn't go ahead on Saturday because of what had happened. And kind of looking back, I'm wondering, how is it that the championship playoff final continued?
It was an odd incident in that nobody was really sure what had happened. He left the field reasonably quickly, and at the time people wondered if he'd just kind of sort of fainted. I think it was pretty warm on the day. It didn't seem as serious as that, and that sounds a really trite thing to say, but from everybody in the ground there wasn't, you know, he got an ovation when he went off, etc., but there wasn't really a sense that something incredibly kind of life-threatening had happened at that moment. Whereas, you know, watching the footage from Saturday, it really did feel like that. I mean, partly, I think, because it was Tom Lockyer and it had already happened, but also because I think people, the way the players were reacting, there wasn't quite that sense at the playoff final. I don't know if that's because we were all being, you know, transfixed in kind of, it's a playoff final and we're all focused on that. And if so, then that's, you know, that paints us all in guilt. But no, it did feel different.
I think one other key difference here is Rob Edwards, the manager, was clearly in no fit state to concentrate on the game. I think because it was Tom Lockyer again, and he knew the possible long-term ramifications for Tom as well, that he wouldn't have been able to continue and to focus on that game. I think it absolutely was the right call.
Excellent. Okay, well, great news that he's doing better, and many best wishes for his recovery. Let's now move on to the action elsewhere in the Premier League on match day 17. Match day 17 saw Liverpool held 0-0 at Anfield by Manchester United. Prior to that, Arsenal had been 2-0 winners against Brighton. Villa also a victorious 2-1 away at Brentford. Saturday, though, Man City slipped again. A 2-2 draw for them at home to Crystal Palace. While Spurs on Friday met Nottingham Forest, and details on that are a bit sketchy. Elsewhere, Everton won their fourth straight game. This time it was at Burnley. Sheffield United lost 2-0 at Chelsea. Newcastle, who will be facing Chelsea in the League Cup on Tuesday, beat Fulham. Gosh, is going down to 10 men after Raul Jimenez was a bit rash in his challenge. And the other game, which we haven't mentioned, is West Ham beating Wolves 3-0. And that's your lot. Singular feature of the Sunday 2 o'clock games wasn't just that West Ham Wolves was the one on telly, but also that of the six managers involved, only two escaped a booking, De Zerbi and Moyes. My money would have been, if you'd said four of the six are going to get a card, my money would have been on Moyes, but no. Anyway, that probably wasn't the biggest story on Sunday, not a Sunday when we had Liverpool facing Man United at Anfield.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Marcella, Cody Gakpo, driving at Shaw. Salah missed out Endo. Alexander-Arnold! Boy, that's close.
Oh, Nana's beaten. He's nowhere near it. I don't think he's even seen it.
Well, we searched high and wide for a bit of comms to big up this game. Beginning of our match report. I might have gone for the bit 20 minutes to go when Peter Drury says, oh, a football match. one that ended 0-0. Much against everyone's expectations. Do you know, it's only the fourth 0-0 in the Premier League this season. We're 17 match days in. Extraordinary. Why was this game 0-0? Matt, were you able to catch much of it?
I was, yeah. And I'm just looking and wondering the same, because I'm seeing that Liverpool had 34 shots at goal, which seems quite extraordinary to have that number of attempts and not manage to score. I just wonder if it was the overpowering narrative from yesterday of Manchester City could be 12 points behind Liverpool by the next time they play a Premier League game, and the footballing gods going, yeah, but maybe not, because they'll draw at home to Man United and then they'll draw with Arsenal, and then Manchester City will have their way back into the title race and things will pan out just as they should. But I don't know, maybe it was because Mo Salah didn't have his scoring boots on. Maybe it's because Liverpool hadn't worked hard enough at corners in training this week, because they had so many of them. It felt like they were duty-bound to produce a goal with one. But yeah, I mean, Man United come out looking good, don't they? It sort of seemed a bit baffling to see Erik ten Hag's pre-match interview talking about how Scott McTominay embodies everything about Manchester United and how he's an example of what it means to play for them. And you're thinking, but didn't you spend half the summer trying to sell him? And the script seemed to have been written for more embarrassment for the Red Devils at Anfield. But they could have won it. You know, that Højlund chance was probably the chance of the game.
Yeah, indeed. You were saying, Adrian, did Liverpool shoot too much?
Possibly. I think they were a bit rash with their shooting, you know, trying things from tight angles, weren't they? Rather than maybe teeing up somebody for a better opportunity. I think you've got to give Manchester United some rare credit here. We haven't given that out a lot this season. They've been shambolic, haven't they? And they haven't been a team. I thought they would be annihilated in this game. I did, because they're going into the cauldron of Anfield. They are not together, or it didn't feel like they were. Yet they mustered up quite a bit of teamwork, and I thought they fought hard. At the ninth time of asking, they've found a centre-back partnership in Johnny Evans and Raphael Varane that did the business for them. So, yeah, I think to face 34 shots doesn't look good, but I think they can come away with some pride, because they put their bodies on the line at key moments and they made some crucial blocks.
What's the Daniel Story verdict?
I just think Manchester United was perceived as so much in crisis, and rightly so, before this game, that everybody sort of tended to overlook that Liverpool have played pretty awfully in open play for the last few weeks. I saw them at Bramall Lane and they were terrible until they scored from a set piece. They beat Crystal Palace because Palace had a man sent off, and then kind of weight of numbers got that done. But they've not been very good in open play. They've kind of been sort of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. They've been too slow in their own half, and then they've been too rushed in the final third and never quite got it right. And Darwin Nunez sums up those final third issues exactly. He's a player who sometimes makes the right decisions, but it does feel like he's doing it by this sort of rapid fire tossing of a coin in his head. And if it lands up the right way, he'll make the right call. And if he doesn't, then he'll just, you know, he'll appeal for a penalty rather than trying to get the ball and score. Or he'll, rather than making a run, he'll just kind of walk into his own teammate. And that just feels like how they are in open play. There doesn't seem an obvious plan, which is very odd, because that is the one constant this season. You know, with Andrew Robertson out injured and the centre-backs having to change occasionally, they're different there. The midfield is completely new, but it's the same forward line as last season. So we kind of thought, OK, well, we're going to see the second season of this forward line coming together. And to my mind, that's the bit of the team that looks the least effective at the moment.
There's no polish still on Darwin Núñez, is there? I thought he looked really raw but exciting last season. He's still raw. I haven't seen a great deal of improvement in him. And I think that is a slight problem for Liverpool, because when a centre-forward is a really important figure for obvious reasons, but they've also got to look after the ball and make good decisions. They often set the tone. And if that guy at the top end of the pitch is erratic, then I think a lot of the football can become that way too. So, yeah, that is a problem, I think, for Jurgen Klopp. I worked on the Fulham game and they were really loose defensively in that one too. And in the second half, after I hot-footed it over here from Emirates Stadium, Manchester United looked really threatening on that break. They just lacked that confidence, really, to finish anything. But I think Liverpool are, at both ends of the pitch, not at their best.
OK. Last Man United player to score at Anfield. Anybody know who that was?
Jesse Lingard, I think.
Yep, 5 years ago. Well, just on the subject of it being a 0-0 and only the fourth such result of the season, anybody got a theory as to why we haven't had more goalless draws?
I mean, I think the vague theory, and it is just that, is that the kind of accumulated fatigue of last season has meant that pressing is not quite as intense. So teams are finding a way to create bigger chances, and it goes without saying, if you haven't had a 0-0, but goals are up this season, expected goals are up this season. I think teams are just a bit more open because they're probably a little bit more tired off the ball.
Right, and there's Burnley in the league as well, so that
Yes, there are three worse teams than there were last season, although Leeds and Leicester weren't, and Southampton were hardly brilliant at defending either.
Matches are quite a bit longer, aren't they, this season? I think we have to take that into account. And almost every team in the division now wants to roll the dice inside their own penalty box and play out from the back, which never used to happen.
Indeed. All right, well, next up for the Reds, they'll be hosting West Ham in the quarterfinals of the Carabao Cup on Wednesday. And then Arsenal will be visiting Anfield in a big battle of the top two, only 1 point between them. That's next Saturday. Woof. Very shortly, we'll discuss what happened to Arsenal in their clash with Brighton and the other Sunday 2 o'clock games. Stay with us.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
You did stick around, listener. Hooray, because now we're going to talk about Arsenal's 2-0 win over Brighton. Adrian was there. We'll also hear from Jacob Tantor about what Villa got up to at Brentford, and maybe find time for West Ham Wolves 3-0 to the Hammers. That was on the telly. Let's start, though, with the game they're calling the spiciest match of the season, Brentford-Villa. Jacob Tanswell. How many incidents were there and what caused all the trouble?
To be fair, towards the end, there was too many to count. I think it all started with Ben Mee's red card. Brentford felt very unfortunate about it. And before that point, it was an okay game. It was fairly average bog-standing game in terms of there wasn't much incident between or controversy between the two teams. But then Ben Mee's red card seemed to like the paper in a way, in terms of they're feeling a little bit of unjust, and it just continued from there. I think it didn't help that Villa didn't quite find their rhythm, and they had to go to old-fashioned tricks at some points to get the victory in the end. But there was a few, and that last 10 minutes, James, was absolute carnage.
1-0 when Ben Nee left the field. 1-0, that is, to Brentford, but it ended up a 2-1 Villa victory, which leaves them just 1 point behind Arsenal at the top of the table, level with Liverpool. Were Brentford the better side for much of the game then?
Yeah, they were dominating, really. And just before Ben Mee got sent off, they really looked in cruise control. They looked like Villa had run out of ideas. Brentford should have gone two up. You know, Risa had a header. They had a one-on-one. They were continually exploiting Villa's offside trap. They were playing direct. They were turning Villa's centre-backs. And yeah, Villa looked leggy, really. They looked like a team that had played in Bosnia on a Thursday night. And they've had issues away from home. They've drawn at Wolves, they lost to Forest, they drew at Bournemouth, and it looked like it was going to follow the same way, really, in terms of performance. But luckily, from Villa's perspective, that incident did change the game and gave them the initiative, really.
Okay, and their 25th Premier League win in 2023, which is their highest tally ever in a calendar year, follows on from the result midweek, as you say, away in Bosnia. What did they do? Was it 1-1?
1-1, yes, yeah, forgettable.
Forgettable, but enough to take them through to the last 16 of the Conference League directly. There we go, instead of facing a playoff. Meanwhile, for Brentford, 5 defeats now in 6. Jacob, have a great journey home, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Thank you very much.
Those are scenes we all love to see. People, you know, players, fracas, that kind of thing. So let's just take this a moment or two to savour the Mope Martinez friction, the Ollie Watkins scene as well. Danny, what? Sorry, I've just called you Danny. Not sure where that came from. But anyway, Daniel.
Hey, Danny, let's just stick with it.
Daniel.
I liked it.
Daniel, there's been a bit of an update on one of the early kind of moments of tension there when Ollie Watkins stood in the goal and essentially addressed the supporters, his former supporters at Brentford.
Yeah, and he really likes Brentford, and Brentford really liked him until today. He spoke with Thomas Frank after the game, which kind of gave it away that something had happened. It wasn't just his sort of righteous anger. And it sounds like a fan or a few fans behind the goal were abusing his family during the second half. So when he scored the goal, he just pointed to them. And do you know, like, loyalty in that sense is a two-way street. You can't want players to, you know, to kind of do the decent thing and not celebrate against you if you're also going to have people in the crowd being idiotic and abusive towards them. So good on him for doing that. And yeah, it sounds like he's spoken to Thomas Frank and said, look, this is what happened. I still like Brentford. I like you. We hear that him and Thomas Frank still text each other from time to time. So they're clearly matey. But if someone's going to be a dick to you, then give it back. Quite right.
Thank you, Danny. Meanwhile, the other the other scenes were rather more comedy value there with the Neil Mope and Emi Martinez having a bit of back and forth. Matt?
Yeah, you just got to love Emiliano Martinez, haven't you? He's absolute box office for this kind of thing. And Mope's underrated as well in getting involved in aggro. But just to throw it back to Ollie Watkins, I'm really pleased with this trend we've had this season of people not just celebrating, but celebrating with gusto against their old clubs. We had Nathan Ake the other week, didn't we, against Bournemouth. Meaningless late goal, fine. Michael Keane this weekend at it as well. It's what football should be about, isn't it? And this was obviously very, very spicy. And we haven't even got to the Leon Bailey nearly scoring the most amazing own goal of all time. So there's lots to go at in this game.
Tell us about that one.
Back pass that was a shot from the halfway line, which left his goalkeeper scrambling and befuddled. And yeah, were DVDs still a thing, would have been added to the Christmas blooper once in an instant. Good thing about the internet, I suppose. You can do that now. No problem.
Yeah.
Mope and Martinez. Who would have thought it? They are two of the most irritating Premier League players, aren't they?
Are they?
Yeah. Mope goes under the radar.
Neil Mope really is despised by Arsenal fans for a number of meetings where he's been just annoying.
Oh.
Just a little, can I say bag?
Yeah, do we not have a sneaking regard for Emi Martinez and his kind of always elevated state of...
No, I did until that World Cup stuff.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Yeah.
Let me move on then and ask Matt if he enjoyed, if it's players getting in opposing fans' faces. Did you enjoy Paquetá and Kudus twice deciding to celebrate goals sat in front of the Wolves fans at the London Stadium?
You see, I want to say yes to this, but I got so cross with Richarlison for doing it to the Forest fans that I would only be labelled a hypocrite. But right. Yeah, I do broadly enjoy it, James. I do. I think it's part of, you know, if I was commentating on the game, I would get the opportunity to say, well, it is pantomime season after all, which is always one I like to dip into at this time of year. But it's what football's about, right? It's an entertainment industry. You should be able to wind people up, and everybody gets really cross about it in the stadium, and then you leave and think, oh, well, that was just a football match at the end of the day.
Indeed so. West Ham, 3-0 winners over Wolves. The first two goals were both Paquetá to Kudus. A beautiful ball through from Paquetá. And then
balls.
He set up Bowen for the third
as
well.
He did, yeah, hat-trick of assists for Paquetá. I think he's having a terrific season. No one in European football's big five leagues has made more through balls than Lucas Paquetá this season, which is impressive, very impressive. Not least because West Ham don't have loads of the ball, but maybe that's the reason why, where they can just spring those transitions, things open up. And yeah, I mean, a couple of these passes through to Kudus were exceptional. And when you're talking about signings of the summer or best imports of the season so far, clearly you're thinking of Szoboszlai, Van de Ven, Doku, but I also think that Kudus comes into that category. I think he's been fantastic. Some moments are real class.
When you look at him and Alvarez, who also came from Ajax, and you wonder about some of the other Ajax signings that other Premier League sides have made. Well, that raises questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, Marco van Basten in true van Basten fashion said it dead straight as it was. He said in February, I don't know why you'd sign Antony when Mohamed Kudus was available, because he's a better player, he's a stronger player, he's a more fun player for the fans to watch. And I think he's got a higher potential. And from everything we've seen, that looks right. But they weren't, Manchester United weren't the only club that rejected or didn't go for Mohamed Kudus. And as much as £38 million can look a steal, it absolutely does. Because like Paquetá, the reason it works, and it works under Moyes, is that their work off the ball and their strength in kind of protecting the ball is so good, as well as the flair stuff and the through balls and the passes.
There's we ought to praise West Ham, because you look this time last year, or including January, and their signings were people like Danny Ings and Maxwell Cornet and Gianluca Scamacca. And this season, they seem to have had hit after hit with Ward-Prowse as well as Alvarez and Kudus. So there was all that discord at the start of the season, wasn't there, about was David Moyes signing the players, or was it the new sporting director who probably weren't aligned in the same thinking? Well, whoever it was who signed off on these players, every one of them looks like a decent buy at the moment. And most of the West Ham fans of my acquaintance seem to love a whinge about David Moyes' sort of conservatism and approach, particularly to Premier League games. But you look at the difference of their results post-European games and Brighton, say, and how West Ham struggled to manage being in Europe and being in the Premier League last season compared to where they are in the table now. You know, they were flirting with relegation until kind of April time last year. And what are they, seventh now?
Eighth,
because Man United got the point. But, you know, they're still, they're way away from where they were last season. And they won their Europa League group at something of a canter. So
they did. Yeah. 2-0 winners against Freiburg on Thursday to go straight into the last 16 of the Europa League, which means they don't have to do any European football till March, as opposed to having the double playoff with a team dropping out of the Champions League that the runners-up will do. Brighton also through to the knockout stage of the Europa League after their late winner against Marseille on Thursday, but not so fortunate Sunday afternoon when they got, well, battered, you were saying, Adrian. The stats are extraordinary. First half shots, 15-0 to Arsenal.
Yeah, I used those stats at half-time on the show that I was working on. It was remarkable to see Brighton dominated so easily. I'm a big fan of Brighton. I think we probably all are here. They're a quality outfit that are normally incredibly difficult to play against. But this was like watching Arsenal against Burnley or Arsenal against Sheffield United. It was incessant pressure, 26 shots to 6 in the end. I think that Arsenal produced an outstanding performance. I think this must rank among their top two of the season so far.
Performances, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Even as impotent as Brighton were.
Because Arsenal made them that way?
I think so. I think it was a near perfect performance from Mikel Arteta's point of view in terms of the control. So they controlled the game. We know that he loves that. There was also lots of imagination, some really good improvised pieces of football. And clearly they shut out Brighton completely. They just had one effort on goal towards the end of the game at the near post, and that was it. So I think it ticked a lot of boxes. The only thing that was missing was the finishing. And I think had Arsenal brought their shooting boots, this could have been 4 or 5 nil. And no one really has looked like beating Brighton.
Well, Villa
5-0. Apart from
they
Villa,
did them what,
yeah.
six.
That is true. That is true. And this Brighton don't seem as strong. Certainly not defensively as they were last year, but. Even so, I just thought it was a very accomplished all-round performance from Arsenal. That I think Mikel Arteta, it was almost the perfect Mikel Arteta performance, I would say.
Okay.
But it comes back to the Brighton post-Europe thing a bit, doesn't it? You know, not to discredit Arsenal, I'm sure they played really well in the game, but you know, Brighton, after Europe, drew at home to Sheffield United, lost to 10-man Chelsea. They played against 10 men for about 45 minutes. They are clearly having an issue in managing the two things, I think.
Just a word on a couple of individual performances.
Oh, yeah.
I think Gabriel Jesus was outstanding. Mm. Yeah, I mean, he didn't give the ball away once, which I think is phenomenal for a centre-forward because you play as a striker. You're getting defenders all over you. They're trying to knock you over. He executed every pass successfully, which I think is a good achievement. He also produced some great moments of skill in the game. So a word for him. And the others on Declan Rice. And, you know, the supporters that we were speaking to after the game were saying, look, we should probably just cough up some more money to West Ham for Declan Rice. He's just becoming a joke, really. He's just so good. It was as if...
What was he doing that was so good, Adrian?
Well, Brighton, as you know, love to play out from the back, don't they? Like to draw teams in. And every time they played the ball into midfield, Declan Rice was on them, basically intercepting the ball and then shrugging off players. It looked like he was, you know, 2 or 3 years old. It was like he was playing in a kid's game and he was 2 or 3 years older than the other kids in the Brighton engine room. He was that much stronger, that much quicker. He was anticipating everything. It was a really immaculate performance from Declan.
Mm. What about Kai Havertz? Remember the days when he couldn't score? 4 goals in 7 now for him, and Arsenal top of the league.
I know. Yeah, and they were singing his song, which is obviously fun song. Well, it's 60 million down the drain. Kai Havertz scores again. Na 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 na.
Waka waka
waka.
Made popular by Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, it's a beauty of a song, but it was a lovely little 1v1, and he finished with aplomb, which was lovely.
He did, although the keeper ? etc. All right, next up. Let's talk about Brave Palace and their brave 2-2 draw at Manchester City.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
The responsibility falls on Michael Olise. This to draw Palace level and deny City victory. Which he does very calmly indeed.
City on Saturday looking back to their best at home to Roy Hodgson's Crystal Palace. Goals from Jack Grealish and then Rico Lewis had them 2-0 up with a quarter of an hour to play. Every single City outfield player had created a chance and it was total dominance. And then it happened all over again, just like with Spurs, just like with Liverpool, just like with Arsenal, and just like even with Chelsea, City undone by late goals. Jean-Philippe Mateta pulled one back in the 76th minute. And then Phil Foden kicked out at Mateta in the box, and there's a penalty, and Michael Olise with nerves of steel converts. And that's now one win in six for City in the Premier League. Their worst start ever to a Premier League campaign under Guardiola. What's happening with Man City is a big question. Well, first off, Adrian, you were commentating on this game. First off, Palace happened.
Oh, well played, Crystal Palace. They just stuck in the game. They held their nerve. They are injury ravaged to an unbelievable degree. So much so that they basically picked nine defenders, and the only two attacking players were Michael Olise on the right wing and Jean-Philippe Mateta up front, both of whom were magnificent in the game because they didn't have very much of the ball. But every time Olise got it, he travelled with it. He took them up the field. And Mateta was a force of nature, really, in terms of just chasing down everything and hassling Manchester City defenders. And we saw that in the build-up to the penalty that they got in injury time. So they defended brilliantly, you know, blocked everything, well, except the two goals that City scored, of course. But yeah, they held their nerve. They had to put on a kid. David Ozo was only 18. Big, powerful central midfielder who'd only played 14 minutes of Premier League football previously. And he came into this game and he was a towering presence, I've got to say. Mm-hmm. He was excellent, putting himself about. He looked after the ball beautifully as well. So well done to him. Well done to Palace. For City, it's a disaster of a result. Absolute disaster.
Well, so Palace scored with both their shots on target, and you might feel that they were a bit fortunate with that. However, should they not have been facing 10 men for most of the game? Edison's challenge on, remind me who he was taking out at
Mateta.
That time. There you go, on Mateta. Should that not have been sanctioned with the red?
Yeah.
No, don't
I? Yeah, it was a kind of classic sort of orangey challenge, I think.
Wasn't it?
Well, it was exactly the same as it was a completely different incident, but I thought about that exactly the same as I thought about Luke Shaw's for United on Sunday, in that, yes, it is that middle ground, and if it's a middle ground, I think you probably generally err on the side of yellow. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those, you want it for your team and you argue it's a yellow when it goes against you, and that's the golden rule. I mean... My takeaway on City at the moment is, I think the really interesting thing is, I think they're paying again for not buying another striker, because not just because Erling Haaland's out, but Julian Alvarez last season, I was looking at this, because I kind of thought Julian Alvarez must have played an awful lot of football. Is he just tired? And then he only started 13 league games last season. And basically he was the most used substitute pretty much in Europe. He came on in 30 times, I think, for City in all competitions. He's one of only two players to start every game for City this season. And he just doesn't look as good starting games as he did coming off the bench and impacting them against tired defenders. And I think teams can just stay in the game against City a bit more. Palace actually have a really good record at the Etihad. But it feels like last year that sort of game would have been 3 or 4-0. And then everybody, you know, if there is a late sloppiness, it's 4-1 rather than 2-2. And you know, I know Guardiola thinks every time someone has a shot against us, it goes in, and there is definitely an extent of that. But I think there are little things that just aren't working the same way, and it's not necessarily as simple as we conceded goals, we're not defending very well. I think it starts much higher at the pitch.
Manchester City in need of a reliable goal scorer, maybe from good stock. I mean, it's strange to dip into the academy if you're Manchester City, I guess. But you know, if you've got Emil Heskey's son, Jaden, playing for your under-21s, you know, maybe you get that bit of footballing legacy and see how it works.
Very nice. Pep was talking about it being... Did he blame carelessness afterwards? And I'm not sure, does this feed into the same kind of... Well, for Liverpool, it was a quadruple they were chasing, but the post-treble fatigue, whether physical or maybe mental, of a group of players who've been right to the end of gone deep in multiple competitions the season before. And if it is that, sorry to extend this question still further, but why is it that Pep doesn't make substitutions earlier in games? Does he just not trust his bench?
That might be a factor. I think what he was talking about here specifically was giving away silly penalties, which was exactly what they did at Chelsea, wasn't it? And I think that, you know, it's kind of do it once, okay, fine, but do it in a second game. You could see why that would be really frustrating for a manager. But it did give us that magnificent shot, didn't it, of Roy Hodgson, who's been threatening a full heel turn in recent weeks with his grumpiness, but looking all avuncular and slightly ornithological at Pep Guardiola across the dugout and making everything seem right in the world. But yeah, I think it comes back to fatigue, doesn't it? And you're probably right, James. It probably should make substitutions earlier in the game because tired players make bad decisions. Hmm. And that's what Foden did.
There you go, Pep.
I think Ilkay Gundogan is, you're seeing his absence felt as well, because in games where City weren't really doing a great deal, he just had that habit, didn't he, of popping up and delivering in key moments. The two players that he kind of brought in to replace them were both on the bench in this game, Kovacic and Mateus Nunez. Neither was called upon in the game, which I find interesting. You know, has he lost trust in those guys? Does he not believe that they can come on and deliver for him? I don't know. But I think that Gundogan isn't they're feeling that absence big time.
And yes, City fans, you're also without Kevin De Bruyne.
Oh yeah.
And Erling Haaland in this game, and John Stones with all the multiple qualities that he brings to City's play. Off they go then to the Club World Cup. By the time they return, how many points could they be behind? 12?
10 now, I guess.
10 now, yeah.
10 points behind Arsenal. They won't be playing in the Premier League until the 27th of December, Man City, because of their activities in Saudi Arabia. On Tuesday, 6 p.m. UK time, they'll be facing the semi-final against the Japanese Urawa Red Diamond, who were 1-0 winners against Mexican side Lyon in their quarter-final. Urawa Red Diamond are 2022 Asian Champions League winners. Dan Orlovitz, who's been on this show before, describes them as brutally efficient in defence but lacklustre in attack. So, yeah, could be an interesting match on Tuesday. The other semi-final, we'll see Fluminense, the South American champions, up against Al Ahly, who knocked out Karim Benzema's Al Ittihad in the quarterfinal. Crikey. But have lost Anthony Modeste in the process. That's enough on the Club World Cup. Anyway, City going out there. Oh, no. Hello, Daniel.
To somehow talk more about the Club World Cup, Alex Schalk, who scored the winner for Urawa Red Diamonds against Lyon. His last two clubs were Servette in Switzerland and Ross County in Scotland.
Wow.
That is a heck of a weird career to go on.
Good for him.
Yeah. We can see how this goes, though, doesn't it? As I sort of alluded to, because we've got this Liverpool-Arsenal game coming up. City go away, get some sun on their backs, win the Club World Cup, come back, find out that their rivals have taken points off each other, and then they go into the second half of the season, do what they do and walk away with the title again.
Are they going to do it again, though, Matt?
Depends how long Haaland's out for, I suppose, but I'm not sure I trust Liverpool or Arsenal to maintain their current form.
Okay. All right. Duly noted. Next up, let's check out the other games which took place this weekend in the Premier League.
Hello, listeners. Danny Kelly here, host of The View from the Lane, your dedicated Spurs podcast from The Athletic. Myself, Charlie Eccleshare, James Moore and Tim Spears are with you twice a week every week this season as we bring you all the news and views you could ever possibly want from in and around the club. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of The View from the Lane.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Full Time Europe, the Athletic's women's football podcast, will be out on Tuesday. They'll probably be talking about Spurs' victory 1-0 over Arsenal Saturday lunchtime. What a Spurs goal that was.
Here's Bizet. Naz is making herself available too. Bizet across, looking for Thomas! Tottenham Hotspur have the advantage in the North London derby.
The copy of Ange Ball, this is the claim from Tottenham's coach, who the improvement over the last few months has been extraordinary. No, I mean, nobody saw this coming. And Arsenal, who, I mean, they beat Chelsea last weekend, and then, I mean, it just smacks of ultimate complacency. But yeah, a huge result for Spurs, who are, you know, they see themselves as, the Athletic did a piece this week, actually, kind of behind the scenes with them, where they really do want to be another force in women's football. You know, they're doing this properly. They're not just, they're walking the walk as well as talking the talk. And that's obviously a statement win. There were two statement wins this weekend, because Liverpool also beat Manchester United on Sunday before the men's game. And they are another team who have come an awful long way under Matt Beard in a pretty short space of time.
All right, Matt, you were doing the Chelsea game Sunday.
Yeah, I was. I sort of wonder, by the way, if Matt Beard might be a contender to replace Emma Hayes. He's a former Chelsea manager, so there would be some logic to that. But yeah, huge for Chelsea. You look really, really sort of weary against Hecken in the Champions League in midweek and struggled to create good quality chances. And probably a trip to Bristol City, with the bottom team in the league, was good for what ails them. And they scored some excellent goals. Lauren James in particular, sensational, really nice Erin Cuthbert volley as well. And as soon as it's 2-0 at half time, you think they're going to go on and win it pretty comfortably, which they did. And they got Maika Hamano on for her debut in the second half, which gives Chelsea another option in those kind of wide forward areas, which is pretty scary for the rest of the league. But yeah, you know, a week ago we're talking about Chelsea getting absolutely humiliated in front of a record crowd at the Emirates and losing 4-1, and here we are going into the winter break. They don't play in the league again until the third week of January, and they're 3 points clear at the top of the table, which is very Emma Hayes Chelsea-like.
Remarkable. All right, well, you can hear more in Full Time Europe. The Totally Football Show's European edition will also be out on Tuesday, no doubt discussing Sevilla bidding off yet another manager. Diego Alonso's got fired. He had 12 games in La Liga and Champions League, won none of them. They're now looking for their fifth permanent manager since the start of last season, are Sevilla. We'll also take in the Champions League last 16 draw, which will be happening on Monday. Anyway, tune in on Tuesday to the Totally Football Show's European edition. Well done to Rangers, who won the Scottish League Cup final on Sunday, 1-0 over Aberdeen. Rangers also, speaking of things in Seville, they became the first team, the first visiting side this season to win a game at Real Betis when they defeated Manuel Pellegrini's side 3-2. To go through to the last 16 of the Europa League. Last Scottish side in Europe doing their bit for the coefficient. Lovely stuff. League Cup in England as well. That's coming up this midweek. Are you excited by the quarterfinals? Shall I just run them by you? Liverpool taking on West Ham on Wednesday. Port Vale Borough. It's another one.
I'm there.
Are you going?
I'm there. So Port Vale Borough. Don't mock it.
I'm not mocking it.
Oh, Danny's a hipster, isn't he?
Chelsea.
Robbie Williams.
Chelsea's at
I'll be duetting.
Chelsea's at home to Newcastle, and Everton play Fulham. I was going to start with Everton, but let's hear about Port Vale Borough. Why, Daniel? Why?
I think it's a really cool game because it's to get into a semi-final domestic cup competition. I know Middlesbrough are no secret that they've been a really good cup team down the years, but I think Port Vale can do it. It's a pretty incredible story if they get to a semi-final of the EFL Cup, particularly given over the last 4, 5, 6 years, maybe even a decade, that competition has become dominated by big Premier League teams starting to pick stronger teams from the quarterfinals onwards. So the draw has obviously helped, but yeah, it just feels like a really good shootout to get into a semi-final.
Excellent, excellent. The other game's full of Premier League-ness. Everton playing Fulham. Everton, who just got their fourth straight win. This one was away at Turf Moor, a return there for Sean Dyche and a couple of Everton players as well. It's the first time in 21 years that the Toffees have gone four league wins in a row without conceding a single goal. They are now a point better off than they were at this stage last season, even with that 10-point deduction. Wow.
Impressive. Yeah, really impressive. I think that he's building something. What made their victory at Burnley stand out for me was that he had so many players out. He's had this 4-4-1-1 formation that was working beautifully, but three of his back four were missing. So he revamped it to kind of a 3-5-1-1, and they were just as good, if not better. I do think the two wingers have been great. Harrison and McNeil, I think they make a real difference. Calvert-Lewin being fit helps, we know that. But yeah, they've become a pretty fit, powerful, strong team.
These are record equaling runs by a manager who at times last season just looked like he wasn't quite able to turn it into his team. Dominic Calvert-Lewin being fit helps. The wingers are, you know, Adrian's right, absolutely brilliant. But it's players like, you know, you heard James Tarkowski talk after the game, and I know he knows Dyche and Burnley, but he's talking like he's enjoying his football more than he ever has in his career. Seamus Coleman, you know, they all say he's leading the team like nobody from the dressing room like nobody else.
One of the
has
best
before.
Humans, isn't he? According to Frank Lampard,
yeah,
the world's best humans.
Is that right?
Yeah,
I'd love to see his top 100.
That's the Frank Lampard who throws out Abdoulaye Doucouré, who now seems to score in pretty much every game for Everton. I think that man management side of Dyche is something that's probably quite underrated, just because of his demeanour. He's kind of pigeonholed as not a ranter and a raver, but kind of basics. Let's do the bleep test and run as hard as we can, lads. But I think actually his man management
eating
skills,
worms.
Quite. Which was not true, was it? Having seen them, live last week. Really impressed by the way you organise them, and particularly in this game, because Mikulenko pulled out late, didn't he? And he said in his post-match, well, what we did is we didn't have a session to work on the new formation, so we showed him that good clips of them doing it well in a game that we played earlier in the season, and didn't kind of focus on the negatives, but said, look, you've done this before, you can do it again. And lo and behold, they kept their fourth clean sheet in succession. And I said this before, they've got, because it's Fulham at home in the League Cup quarterfinal, and yeah, Fulham have been better of late, but
they'll be without Raúl Jiménez here.
Well, quite, yeah. And it could be a glorious season for Everton. We might even get a Merseyside Derby League Cup final, which would be something pretty spectacular.
Amazing.
Unless it's Port Vale, of course.
Yeah. Jiménez, who was sent off after just 23 minutes of Fulham's clash this weekend in the Premier League, away at St James's. They were beaten 3-0 by Newcastle. It was
spectacular.
A spectacular challenge, or the Newcastle performance? Both?
No, I don't care about the performance. The challenge was, I think the weirdest red card I've seen. It was both simultaneously incredibly weird, and yet also when you watch it in slow-mo, you can see every one of Raúl Jiménez's thoughts as he's going, because he kind of flies into it and he's lost his head. And then he realises a second too late that he needs to bring his foot down, at which point he's just careering in the air. And his anus hits Sean Longstaff's face. There's no other way to describe it.
It nearly takes his head off, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I was impressed by Marco Silva moaning about the referee after the game. That was kind of peak Premier League 2023 for me, because, if the rule is reckless, then I think flying through the air unable to stop into someone's face with any part of your body is probably reckless.
Yeah. Especially the anus. First senior
Raúl Jiménez,
First senior goal for 17-year-old Lewis Miley as well, who's very much filed among the good news for Newcastle, who with that remain in and around the battle for top four, or is it five?
We'll have to see. Yes, Arsenal City are under pressure, aren't they, to deliver in the Champions League. They've got two more players out, haven't they, Newcastle? Cher came off and Joel Linton. So they're pretty depleted for that cup game at Chelsea.
Is that, because it is extraordinary how much Newcastle have been hit by injuries. Is it because of that, or is it the other way around, cause and effect, that Eddie Howe was using the same 10 outfield players for 63 games in a row?
I think that is a big factor. I just think they've had to play 90 after 90 after 90, and it's catching up with them. A lot of these are muscle injuries, aren't they? So they've just got to get on with it, Newcastle United. But this is a big win. I thought Fulham had potential to go there and get a result. They started the game quite well, Fulham, but the outcome of this match hinged totally on the Jiménez tackle.
Okay, next up for Newcastle, as mentioned, the quarterfinal with Chelsea, who themselves were 2-0 winners against Sheffield United. Matt, you were there at this game.
I was, yeah. And I wondered if we'd even talk about it at all after the first half, because it was such a non-event. But it ended up being pretty significant for Chelsea. I think it's one of those where, the automatic response is to say, well, you beat the team who are bottom of the league at home. There's not much you can take from that. But it's a critical week in Chelsea's season with this League Cup quarterfinal, which is, by far the biggest game that they will have played so far. So they absolutely had to go into it with some positivity. But also, I think it was reassuring to see Maurizio Pochettino make a tactical change but one which impacted the game and ended up winning it for them, because he's been so rigidly stuck to the formation, and as much as he can be with their injury problems, the personnel, that to see, it's quite a simple thing, I suppose, to put Cole Palmer from the 10 role out wide and swap Sterling round, and they were both involved in both of the goals, having looked in the first half as if nobody was going to score in the match. So I think that maybe gives a bit more. Chelsea fans are still very much on the fence about Pochettino, particularly those who get cross with the fact that he's seemingly got no interest in playing anybody from the academy. When you look at Lewis Miley, for example, and what he's come in and done for Newcastle. But this was important for Pochettino, I think, to show that he can still affect games himself during them. And yeah, Cole Palmer, I mean, it was said, Danny Murphy said it on Match of the Day, didn't he? But it's extraordinary for a 21-year-old who'd barely started a Premier League match before he came to Chelsea to be the most important player in the team. You know, Conor Gallagher might make an argument that he could lay claim to that too, but Palmer is just absolutely pivotal to the way that Chelsea play at the moment. And he's the only one of the forward players who is playing as if he's brimming with confidence. He wants the ball all the time, and every time he gets it, there's a buzz of anticipation that something's going to happen, and more often than not, it does. And he was the difference maker in this match. He was absolutely superb.
All right, Chelsea fans on the fence. Christopher Nkunku on the bench, meantime. Matt, I noticed that you've already made a song for him.
Yeah, I have. The end of it needs work, if I'm honest, and maybe we'll workshop that.
Well, how does it go?
Straight out of Cobham tomorrow. So I feel it's got to be to the tune of Agadoo because of Nkunku. So
there's your Agadoo in the background. Take it away, Matt.
We're working with that. Just give me a second while I get it up. Here we go. Nkunku had a problem with his knee. Nkunku delayed his debut for Chelsea. To the left, to the right, blowing up balloons all night. He is class latching onto a pass, and we're thrilled to see him on the grass.
Perfect.
Well, I'll stop you there.
The other League Cup quarterfinal is Liverpool against West Ham.
Yeah, I should just say that Cole Palmer's got a much better song than that, which the Chelsea fans have come up with, which gives a nod to everything that's happened at the club over the last year, which I think is nice to see from the Chelsea supporters. It's to the tune of Ring of Fire, and it goes, running from the left to right, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Cole Palmer is dynamite, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, sign him up for 8 more years, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, Chelsea boys are on the beers, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So nice. Well done to whoever came up with that one. It's better than my Nkunku one, but I was under pressure. And yeah, straight out of Cobham tomorrow, the Chelsea FC podcast from The Athletic. If you've got a better one, do let us know at SO Cobham Pod on X, currently known as.
Yep. Daniel, anything you want to add to that?
Any songs, Danny?
Well, Matt kind of expressed his disdain at Adrian singing a chant that they'd nicked from Forest, and that Nkunku chant is nicked from Newcastle when they used to have Hosse Lu. They used to sing Hosse Lu Lu Lu, might score one, he might score two, which you could probably put that line in as well if you want, Matt. Yeah. If you want to steal it all.
All right. It's a collaborative thing. More than happy to accept.
The Cole Palmer one's good. I don't like to praise Chelsea fans, but the Cole Palmer one's good.
What were they singing on Friday night at the City Ground, Daniel?
It's been really interesting hearing the Steve Cooper chant over the last few weeks, because it always used to be the kind of overwhelming support. You know, he's going to get sacked, so the fans will sing his name to say, we don't want him sacked.
How does that song go, Daniel? Just give us a rendition.
I won't be singing it. But over the last few weeks at Fulham and Wolves and on Friday night, there's a definite tinge of thanks and farewell and we're sorry you're leaving, but this feels like you're going to be losing your job soon. Ooh. Feel to that. Forest were, I think, the better team for large parts of Friday evening, but they have a problem in that one bit of quality. Well, there's two distinct problems. One is that they make mistakes that generally lead to goals. Matt Turner did that for the second when Forest were on top. And secondly, they've actually got the same problem as Sheffield United this season, which is the counter-pressing really gets them. So when they choose to sacrifice possession, and then when you win the ball back, you have to be able to protect it and do something with it, because if you can't then keep the ball for more than 5 seconds, you're suddenly inviting pressure and you're under pressure for extended periods of time, and they haven't been good enough to kind of thwart that pressure. They're not as bad as Sheffield United at it, but they are not good. As soon as they win the ball back, they are swarmed and they struggle to play more than 3 passes.
All right, Spurs winning this one 2-0, goals from Dejan Kulusevski, who also set up the other goal, scored by Richarlison, to the delight of the home fans. Adrian, were you warming up to pitch into this?
I was going to say something, going to ask Daniel a question about Forest. Because I covered the game against Wolves and I thought they were superb in that game, like going back to basics with this back three and the back, the decision to go back three last season towards the end, ground out the results to get them over the line. Can you see this lasting and can it save Steve Cooper yet again?
No, I can't because various reasons, the results aren't good enough at the moment. Evangelos Marinakis, I think privately rather than publicly, but he wants Forest finishing the top 10. He also wants Forest to play with a style that they're not playing with at the moment and that isn't that back three and deep line defence and grinding out results. I think that is the best approach at the moment, particularly when Tara and Aaron is out, although they can't get a result at all without him out. But the reality is that at Fulham, when they got hammered, they played with eight new players and they played with three new players against Wolves and again against Spurs because they're the players he trusts, I think. And that doesn't really feel sustainable because Marinakis sanctioned £30 million on Ibrahim Sangare and I think he'd probably quite like him to play. So, no, that doesn't feel sustainable. I am actually surprised he's in a job. I thought he might go this weekend.
One win in 13 now for Forest. Spurs, meanwhile, with a handy victory to keep themselves on the fringes of however many Champions League places the Premier League receives for next season. They will be facing their next game, which is with Everton, as it happens, next Saturday, without Yves Bissouma, who's got sent off for the second time this season. Oh, and they're going to be without him for AFCON as well in January. So, yeah. Anyway, that is the state of play after 17 match days of this Premier League. Matt, anything else you want to add?
You know what, James? There is, and you'll forgive me for this because it's very, very niche, but I did a game on Saturday morning between Chelsea's under-18s and West Brom's under-18s. It finished 9-1 to Chelsea, and I want to just give a little mention, a little shout-out. I'm sure he doesn't listen. He's a 17-year-old Ivorian called Cech Kone, who scored what is comfortably the best goal I've seen all weekend. He picked the ball up about halfway inside his own half, beats a couple of players, absolutely larrups one into the bottom corner of the net. A wonderful goal. Unfortunately for him, the score was 8-0 against his team at the time. So this poor lad turns around. There's none of his teammates anywhere near him. He knows he can't celebrate the goal. Who knows whether he goes on to have a career in football or not. This might be as good as it gets for Cech Kone, scoring this absolute wonder goal. And the disappointment on his face just made me so sad because he knew, as we all knew, that it meant absolutely nothing and none of his teammates would even shake him by the hand or pat him on the back. And I just felt so sorry for poor young Cech Kone. It finished 9-1. Chelsea were so affronted by that, they went up and scored straight away. But I feel your pain, Cech Kone, and I enjoyed your goal. So you just keep plugging away and we'll see what happens.
Look that out on YouTube. I'm going to enjoy that straight after we wrap this pod, which we're pretty much at the point of doing. Daniel, many thanks. Look forward to reading your verdicts in The Score, in The Eye, on Monday morning. Matt, back with not only Straight Out of Cobham, but also What the EFL, with Adrian, perhaps. Is that right, Adrian? You joining Matt?
Yeah, I should be there.
Yeah, excellent. All right, good. And you as well, Adrian, thank you for coming in with your knitwear and your knowledge. Fantastic. Many thanks to Liam and Charlie in the booth. And you, listener, we're back Tuesday morning with the Euro crew. Do join us for that. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.